Welcome to the Work Hard, Play Hard podcast. My name is Rob Murgatroyd, and I'm a former doctor turned lifestyle entrepreneur. Each week, I interview some of the best minds on the planet on the science of achievement and the art of fulfillment. Come take this journey with me. Excuses are over. It's time to live.
Taste as much as you can. Like if you have a wine tasting at the local wine store, or you know where they have multiple wines and you pay $50, but there's 200 wines, it's well worth the $50.
I was in California and tasted a $3,000 Cabernet, and I gotta tell you, I mean, it was good, but I've tasted ones that, you know, $80, $90, $100 are just as good.
My wife has one winery that she represents in Italy, and it was originally deeded to them by the Roman Empire. I mean, the history is amazing with these places, how old and how far back they go.
Okay, before we jump into this interview, I want to invite you to be considered for my 2019 Traveling Mastermind. So go to workhardplayhardmastermind.com and fill out the application, and we'll jump on a call to see if you're a great fit. This year, we'll be in Boston doing lots of cool things like training with Tom Brady's trainer, Alex Guerrero. In the middle of the year, we'll be heading to Monaco doing things like vintage car rides through the French Riviera. And then we're going to wrap the year in Florence, Italy, doing things like truffle hunting and hot air ballooning over Florence. Look, life is all about fulfillment, and I really try and walk the walk. So if you are looking to be part of our tribe of 28 high-achieving entrepreneurs that are in the six- and seven-figure range, fill out your application at workhardplayhardmastermind.com to be considered. So think of the mastermind as having two parts. The first is the trip itself. And the second part is what goes on over the 4 days within the mastermind. Our group of 28 entrepreneurs will help you brainstorm and accelerate what you want to achieve in 2019. And we'll do that through a variety of different exercises, brainstorming activities, breakout sessions, goal setting sessions, you know the drill. So go to workhardplayhardmastermind.com, fill out an application, and we'll jump on a call to see if you're a fit. All right, let's jump into today's episode. What's up, everybody? This is Rob Murgatroyd, and welcome to another episode of the Work Hard, Play Hard show. This episode features Jim Favre. So I wanted to have Jim on the show because I am becoming obsessed with learning about wine. I used to, I didn't care about it, but now all of a sudden, I don't know what happened, I don't know why it happens, I don't even know when it happens, but I can't get enough knowledge about wine, where it's made, the vineyards that it comes from, what year was it made, how was it made. I'm becoming obsessed. So if you want to learn more about wine, this is the episode for you. If you could care less about it, don't listen to this episode because you're not going to get anything from it. We dug deep into wine. I learned about Jim through a mutual friend, Brandon Thompson, who's a real estate guru in my mastermind. And he told me all about him. So I can go on and on and on with his background in wine distributing. And, you know, he was a former panelist and wine judge for the Wine Report. He started a company called Stellar Selections, representing a bunch of wineries from Italy, France, California. But trust me, I can read two pages of his bio. The dude knows wine and he's great to listen to. So I think this is going to be a treat if you want to expand your knowledge in this area. I loved this episode. So be sure to take a screenshot, share it on the socials. Remember to tag me. Let me know what you thought about it. Without further ado, please enjoy this conversation I had with Jim Favre. Jim, welcome to the show.
Good morning, or good afternoon, Rob.
good morning, good afternoon. Listen, with the power of podcasts, it could be in China right now, right? There is no time. We've transcended time and space with this medium.
That's true. That is very true. Amazing.
So I am beyond excited to do this interview. So thank you for taking the time, and thank you for, I know you got a lot going on in your life. So thank you for being able to fit this into your schedule.
I am just very pleased to be on here and excited to chat with you and kind of tell you what's going on.
Okay, cool. So I think what we'll do is the show will have three parts. The first one is we'll talk about how you do what you do in the world of wine and all things wine. Okay. And then we're going to move a little bit into the art of fulfillment and talk about maybe some things that you do personally to help you feel more fulfilled. And then we'll wrap up with some rapid fire questions. Cool?
Sounds good.
All right. So let's, just by way of background, let's go back to Cincinnati, Ohio. Why was Frank Robinson one of your childhood heroes?
Frank Robinson, I thought, was an amazing player. And, you know, just growing up in Cincinnati, which is the first professional baseball team there was, it has a long history. And he was always a go-get-em kind of guy and always produced well on the field.
You know what? I have to tell you, I think Ohio, no knock to Ohio, please, but it's one of the most underrated places ever. I was just in Columbus, Ohio, and I freaking loved it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful state to live in. The only downside is the weather. If you get past the weather, and I still have family up there in Cincinnati, it's a beautiful, beautiful state with lots of history. And three different areas, kind of the Cleveland area, the Columbus area, and the Cincinnati area. But very, very interesting. There's a lot of history. A lot of famous people from there.
Oh, for sure. All right. So I want to make sure that I squeeze as much wine into this conversation as I could. So I'm gonna jump right into it. You were pulling wine orders on the third shift when you were 18 years old, and then you went on to delivering wine on a truck, and then you went into wine sales, and you've been bouncing around. But what was the first spark that you knew that this was it? Wine was for you. How did this enter your life?
I think the moment, the ta-da moment, was when I first went into a warehouse. And I was dating a girl at that time whose father was the foreman there, and I needed a job out of high school like a lot of kids. And I just saw these pallets stacked three high with all these wines. I was kind of like a kid in Disneyland. It was like amazing to see just the size of this. And as I got further into the business, I learned more and more about the wines themselves and had some great teachers along the way, some great people that taught me a lot about wine, and that really kind of sparked it, because I went to the University of Cincinnati studying marketing and advertising. My dad had an advertising agency, and I thought that was the role I was going to play, and you know, here I am all these years later, you know, in the wine business. So it kind of hooked me right away.
Well, what were the steps that got you into the wine import part of the business?
So to get in the import, I worked for two very large Italian wine importers, and I was working for a distributor in Atlanta and happened to work with one of the regional managers. We were out in the Atlanta market, and he went to the company I was working for and said, "Hey, we'd like permission to talk to your employee and bring him on board." And, you know, that's kind of where it started, and that's how I got into the Italian import business at that time, and it was a great learning experience. It certainly changed things.
All right, so if we fast forward a little bit to 2016, that's when you started Stellar Selections, right?
Correct. Yes.
What is Stellar Selections, and why did you start it?
Okay, Stellar Selections. We are a wine brokerage company, and I'll explain what that is because a lot of people don't understand that. What we do is we are representatives for wineries. So say you live in Oregon and you have a mom and pop operation, and it's, you know, you and your wife and your two kids. Well, you know, you don't have a large budget, you know, you don't produce a lot of wine, but you want to market outside of your state. So I act as your representative in the state. I do the Southeast. I'm licensed in five states down here. And so what they will do is they will pay me commission on what gets sent to the distributor. the distributor when they are the ones that take it out to the restaurants, the package stores. You know, all I am is a link in between the winery and the distributor. But with a small winery, as large as some distributors are, can get lost very easily if they don't have a face out here. And so that's kind of my role, is to be their face of the wineries. And I have about 20 wineries I represent from all around the world. And that's my job, is to be their face.
You know, my brain is exploding. I got the wine book. I've never had it before. If I could be completely frank with you, I did not. I went into a restaurant and I ordered red wine, white wine.
Right.
I didn't know the difference. And I've got this really, my best friend is a bit of a diva and he's a snob. And, you know, we're in Italy together and I'm ordering a glass of wine and I can see he's from England too. So I can see him. He's like, you know, giving me that, like, looking down on me, you know, like, right. You know, shaking his head. And I was like, do you want to pick the wine, big boy? And he's like, yeah. I was like, okay, so he got a Barolo, and he explained to me it was a Nebbiolo grape, and I was like, huh, I really see the difference from this table wine and this wine. So after that, I run a mastermind, and part of the masterminds that I do is basically a bunch of experiences that I bring people through. And I just did one in Boston, and I hired this guy to come in, and we did a comparative wine tasting. His name is Michael Gelb. He wrote a book called How to Think Like Da Vinci, and he did this comparative wine testing. And I don't know what it was about that night, that moment, that book, but I came home and I said, you know what? I am going to learn this. So I reached out to him and, you know, I said, where should I start? And he said, well, you know, start with the Psalm documentary. See what you think about that. So I watched like Psalm 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, my wife's ready to throw me out of the house for a multitude of reasons because I've got the documentaries on. I got a decanter. I've turned into a crazy person. So our mutual friends, you know, suggested that I connect with you. And so I think that what we can do here is maybe provide some help for the people that are at the stage with me, which is like the precipice, like the beginning of, okay, I don't know a lot about wine. I know I want to know more about wine, but some basic, let's call it, like, you know, forgive the pun, low-hanging fruit questions, right?
Sure.
So, all right. So let's first start with selecting a bottle of wine in a store. Let's say that all you know is I like red, right? So
okay.
you go to a wine store that's, you know, not like Trader Joe's, but like a real wine store.
A little independent wine store, yeah.
Yeah, like an independent wine. You walk in, you're like, okay, I like red. So can you walk me through how you should approach selecting the type of red wine that you would want? Like, where do you begin?
Usually, and I used to work for a retailer up in North Georgia, and I used to get this question a lot. And usually, the first thing I ask is, tell me a red wine that you really liked the last time you had one. And say it was a Merlot. And, oh, I had this wonderful California Merlot. I say, okay, that kind of gives me a direction. And I say, are you going to have it with a meal? And, you know, you say, oh, well, I'm going to make lasagna. Okay, I said, well, okay, you like Merlot, and you're going to have lasagna. So I try to find a wine in that profile that would have the same fruit profile that, you know, Merlot might have, and maybe spin you with something Italian. You know, maybe something from the Tuscan area that, you know, has Cabernet Franc, Merlot, and Sangiovese in it, or something along that line, or from Umbria that would have Merlot, Cabernet. So you would kind of get that same feel. So the thing I suggest to people is taste as much as you can. Like if you have a wine tasting at the local wine store, or, you know, where they have multiple wines and you pay $50, but there's 200 wines, it's well worth the $50 because you can taste a variety of things. And then the next thing I would say is follow a vineyard. So like if you love, you know, you love X Vineyard, you love Jim's Chardonnay from California. Well, you know, continue to buy from that wine from that vineyard, because that really kind of tells you where your palate's at, and this winemaker will be consistent in that tasting. So really what I do is I follow wineries. There are certain wineries that I like that I think consistently put out a good product, and it doesn't have to be expensive. I think that's another misnomer that a lot of people have, is that you have to spend a lot of money. That's not true. You can get a great $15 bottle of wine without breaking the bank. And, you know, I've had some of the most expensive wines. I was in California and tasted a $3,000 Cabernet. And I got to tell you, I mean, it was good, but I've tasted ones that, you know, $80, $90, $100 are just as good, and to be quite honest. And I was like, so have faith in the wineries that you like and experiment. Go out on a limb. Try something new. Or probably the best thing to do is, if you have a regular retail store that you go to, get to know the buyer there, and he can really be your friend. And you go like, oh, you know, Rob, it was so good to see you last week. And you say, well, you know, I love that, you know, Italian wine. What do you have similar? And he can start pointing you in the right direction. And then the next time you come into the store, he can say, Rob, I've got the wine for you right here. This just came in. I tasted it. I loved it. You're going to love it. And I think that's really how, is to have faith in the wineries and have faith in your local buyer.
All right. So you're saying try different things. Don't spend too much money. Get a feel for what you've liked in the past, and then select a producer that you know, like, this producer consistently does some good stuff.
Right.
Okay. All right. So I see when I'm walking through the aisles, and by the way, I've turned into like a weird wino. Instead of going to the gym, like before I go to the gym, like I pass and I'm like in my workout outfit with shopping cart walking through the aisles. And I'm like, you know, scanning bottles of wine because I've become crazy obsessed with this thing. And so one of the things I'm looking at is, like, you know, in the middle of the aisle, there's like wines that are maybe, you know, and by middle of the aisle, I mean like eye level, that are like $40, $50, right? And if I go a little higher, I see the $90 to $100. And if I go down, if my eyes go down towards the bottom, I see like the, you know, the $9 bottles of wine. And so, you know, I look up and down and I'm like $100, $50, $10.
Right.
So, like, if you don't know the producer, and there's so many producers, what do you do? I'll tell you what I'm doing, and you can tell me if this is a good idea.
Sure.
I open up my app. I go to Vivino. I take a picture of it, and I look, and I see how many reviews, and if it's too acidic or fruity, and I go, well, okay, this may be good, this may be bad. And I am unconsciously driven by price. In other words, sure, I believe that a $50 bottle of wine is going to be better than a $9 bottle of wine.
Yeah, I mean, it probably will. And well, let me explain the difference between, you know, there was a thing where there was the $2 chuck out there. Let me tell you the difference between a $2 chuck and a $50 bottle of wine. $2 chuck, you know, not to pick on that, but any inexpensive winery, what they do is they buy bulk. And when they buy bulk, you know, it's these machines that go out there and, you know, just they just cut a broad swath of grapes, and there's no refining or anything. It's just like, it is what it is. We're going to grab up these grapes and we're going to crush them, and, you know, we'll see what we get. When you pay a $50 or more bottle, or even less, it doesn't even have to be $50. I'm just saying a more expensive wine. What they've done is you send people out in the field who hand cut those grapes, and then they select right there. Yes, no, leave that one, skip that one. There's hand selection going on there. And then after they put them in these buckets, for lack of a better term, they bring them out to a sorting table, throw the grapes on the sorting table, and then they go through and sort, and they see, well, this doesn't look that good. So there's been a lot of filtering going on to picking the best fruit, and then, you know, they'll put it in the crusher and then go through all that and start the fermentation. So the point I'm trying to make is that there's, and just think about the labor cost. I mean, your labor cost is going to be much higher when you're, you know, having 25, 30 people in the field versus a giant machine that just kind of chops it down randomly and throws it into a destemmer. So, I mean, it's a cost deal and it's a quality deal. So that's your difference between your $2 and your, you know, $20, $30, $50 bottle of wine.
Where did I get the name $2 Chuck? Do you know?
I don't. And I think it had something to do with the guy that came up with the original idea of that. And it just kind of rang. I think it was $2.99, but it just had a good ring to it. And I, from a marketing point of view, it was brilliant. they sell, you know, the bejesus out of that stuff. So, but, you know, that's, you don't know what you'll get. And that's the funny thing about the really inexpensive wines. You may get a good bottle, but the next bottle just may be crap, you know? So you don't know what you're going to get. Where if you get a better bottle of wine, you're going to get more consistency where they actually care what goes in the bottle.
It says, I'm just Googling it now. It says that Trader Joe's started it in California to sell a $2 bottle of wine. And it's turned into 800 million bottles.
Wow.
Within 2 years.
That's a remarkable number.
How about that? Okay, so now, what's your thoughts on Vivino and looking at what other people are commenting about it, if you've used the app, and and what about the, you know, sort of like the ratings that come with it as well?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm a little bit more old school than I remember, you know, back when we used to read publications like The Spectator and Wine Enthusiast and Robert Parker and rate it. But now it's all online on apps. So really my theories are the same. Look at a number of different apps if you can, and kind of get, I always say it's like a barometer, because people used to walk into the store and they would fold open their magazine and say, well, look, this got 91 points from Joe so-and-so, and do you have this wine? And I say, well, just remember, that's one person's opinion, and the best writers will tell you that. Like, this is just my opinion. You may totally disagree with me. So you kind of find a writer that you like, or in this case, find an app that you like, and you kind of agree with the people. Because I realize it's different with an app where you have individuals who send in their thoughts and, you know, what they think the wine is worth, you know, or what value it is. So my answer would be look at two or three of them and get a barometer of kind of like what the weather's like and what the wine, you know what I mean? What the wine is like from different areas to see if this is a good bet or not. It is a bet, and that's kind of how you hit or miss. And, you know, the worst that can happen, you have a okay bottle of wine and you still finish the wine, it's okay. But, you know, I always say that value never goes out of style, and it's a real, to me, in a wine list or a wine store, it's always more exciting when I find a wine that over-delivers. And over-delivers is a term we use a lot in the wine business. You know, the one that you pay $20 for but tastes like a $60 bottle of wine. That's hitting a home run to me.
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. When you don't know what you're doing and every bottle looks the same, you don't know any producers, and you're brand new, the only thing you have is a guy. Is what somebody says or wrote about it.
Right.
So that's the reason why I keep leaning towards that. But I will.
And an app can help you with that.
Okay. So that was my next question. What are your favorite apps to use for that?
I use Cellar Tracker. That's a good one. And I've used the Vivino. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. There's another one called, I believe it's called SOM. And it's a little more detailed. Compendium. I'm sorry, it's Compendium. But those are good ones to use. And, you know, you can still use, like, I think Robert Parker, I know he has an app, and Spectator has an app. But I think probably the one I like, the Cellar Tracker, to me, because you get people who actually own the wines in their cellar, and they can kind of tell you, you know, how you get different people's opinion, you know, oh, I opened it and it was great, or, oh, it needs a few more years. That's a good go-to.
All right, so let's talk about
Wine Search.
So
is another good one.
Wine Search. Okay. All right, so let's talk about it. So now I'm walking down the aisles. I'm a Pinot guy, and I look at Pinot, and I'm like, okay, cool. Now I open Vivino, and I'm like, all right, well, the reviews look pretty good. It's a little bit fruit forward, which I kind of like. The price point is where I want it. Now I look and I say, okay, well, you know, I learned from watching the documentaries that the vintage makes a big difference. 2012 versus 2013 for this particular part of the world is going to be different. And they're not all the same. So now I'm searching through, and now I'm trying to find that year from that producer. Talk to me a little bit about that and whether or not that's a good strategy to do. And do you do that yourself, or, you know, what's your thoughts there?
My thoughts are on that is, first of all, with vintages, I would say vintages are a bigger deal in Europe than they are in California. California does make a difference because, you know, like they had the fire a couple years ago. So, I mean, that's going to affect, taint some of the wine. But California has pretty steady temperatures 90% of the time. Europe, the temperatures are very dramatic. They're changing a lot. So you really kind of watch those. So the way to kind of keep that on track is, you know, if you've got your app and you're looking, you see 2013 is a great vintage for you, then that's where I go with the producer, because, you know, if you go with a great producer, what he'll do is in the poor vintages, he'll sell off his juice and just not bottle or not declare a vintage, or he'll bottle it in a second label, where his regular line of wines will always get the best fruit. That's the difference, you know, between going with a great producer and just like, you know, and that's through, and you're right. If you don't know who the good ones are, it is kind of a minefield, but you just got to taste and you got to trust your palate. And I know that's not the easy way, you know, wish, you know, like we hit a magic button, you go, this wine's great. But if you look on Wine Cellar or Wine Searcher or Vivino and you find, you know, 9 out of 10 people, it's like TripAdvisor and going to a hotel, you know, 9 out of 10 people like it, it must be a decent place.
So I guess at this point for you, because this has, you know, been your life for the last 30 years, you sort of like know where you want to go and how you want to do it. So you don't necessarily like, my guess is that if you're looking for an Italian wine or you want an Italian wine, you know that this was a good year or this was not so good. Is that, mm-hmm. is that right?
Pretty much so. And I do it more on the grower. A matter of fact, my wife and I, who's also in the wine business, she bought a bottle over in Alabama and brought it home, and it was from a great producer, and it was an average year. And we had another one. We happened to have a bottle at home of the previous year, and it turned out that one was slightly better than the other. But you know what? This guy's a great producer, and even though that was kind of an off vintage, it still tasted great. And that's what the great producers can do. They know how to dance this dance. And I'll give you the example. There's a Brunello producer I used to represent, and he's been in the business since the 1500s. So think about that. He has weather records back to the 1500s that are handwritten. I think you know your business by then, you know, like the Weather Channel doesn't go back that far.
I mean, when you're talking to, like, you know, Caesar Augustus and going like, you know, how do you make the wine? You probably got to figure it out.
Exactly. Well, that's funny. My wife has one winery that she represents in Italy, and it was originally deeded to them by the Roman Empire. I mean, the history is amazing with these places, how old and how far back they go. You know, you have wineries that start in the year 1100. I mean, it's just, that's the fascinating part of European wines that I just find amazing.
Now, your wife has an Italian last name. Is she from that part of the world or her ancestors?
Yes. Petrocelli, yeah. So she's part of it came from Napoli, and part of it came up from up north, I believe, in Alto Adige, and she's going to probably kick me if I get the wrong region, but yeah.
That's all right. So we're fellow, she and I are fellow Naples people. My family's from Murgatroyd. My name Murgatroyd is, my dad's son is right. From Wales, but my mom is Cecilia DeVito, and her family is from Naples. So,
two Neapolitans.
We're all criminals. All right. So now let's talk about taking this bottle home.
Okay.
All right. So you take the bottle home, and when I take the bottle, open it up, not open it. That's the wrong term. When I take the cork out and I pour it immediately into a glass, okay, all I taste is alcohol. Okay. And I watched the Somme doc, and they talked about letting it open and mm-hmm. letting it breathe. And so I bought a decanter, mm-hmm. and I went on winefolly.com, and I looked, and I said, all right, so how long should I decant this bottle? And I remember, I don't remember which bottle it was, but it was 2 hours. So I made my wife stand there. She gave me the middle finger for 2 hours because she couldn't drink the wine, and I made her decant it for 2 hours. And I have to tell you, I don't know how much is it in my head, or how much is true, but I tasted a completely different glass of wine.
Absolutely.
When I let this thing sit in a decanter, and I was blown away. So first question on that, how important is it to do that?
It depends on the wine. So once again, we'll talk about less expensive wines and more expensive wines. So the less expensive wines, they're ready to go. You don't need to decant them. You can pop the top and just go to work. The little bit more expensive wines have a higher tannin content. I don't want to get too technical, but it has higher tannins. And tannins and fruit, if you think of them side by side, tannins are what give it the aging. And to give an example, tannins, I don't know if you had a chemistry kit when you were a kid, they had tannins. They're a little brown powder. It comes from the outside of the skin of the grape, and it gives you the ability to age a great wine. So over time, the tannin wears down and the fruit comes forward. So what you're doing is when you decant a wine, you're mixing it in with the oxygen. And that's why you kind of get the decanter and you see guys swirl around his glass. You're mixing the oxygen because the wine's a living creature, and you're kicking it up with the oxygen and enhancing the flavor. So oxygen is not your friend when you're storing wine. But when you're about to drink it, it can really be your friend and change the wine. So you don't need to decant every bottle you have. Your higher-end wines, yes, I would say so. Here's my little secret for deciding whether I need to decant a wine. I open the bottle. I pour a little taste. I pour it in the glass. I swirl the glass and take a sniff. If I get these beautiful fruit aromas and da-da-da-da, and then I taste it and I taste nothing, that tells me it's shut down and it needs to open up. Then I'll pour the rest of the bottle in a decanter, swirl it around, and then the palate will match what my nose picked up. Because, you know, your nose can pick up over 10,000 different aromas. Your palate only picks up 4. So it's really your tool is your nose. And that's why, you know, sommeliers are swirling that wine. They want to get as much of that flavor and aroma going so they can really, when they have to break it down and write down, you know, their notes of all the blueberries and honey and blah, 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 whatever they're going to write, they want to have as much as they can to work with. And that's why you decant it.
So your nose can get 10,000 aromas,
right?
And your palate can get, did you say 4,000?
No, just 4. Just it's sugar, salt, sweet acid.
The taste bud. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And really, your nose does the work.
Your nose does the work. All right. So now, how long do you let it decant? And I know each one is different, but
yes.
Maybe you can give me some rules.
So here's that kind of rule is that the younger the wine, say you get let's take an example. You got a 2015, 2016 California cab, and it's from Howl Mountain or Mount Veeder, and it's just a big ass cab. It's huge. So that one, if you open that, it's probably going to need more time to decant because it's younger. An older wine, let's say, you know, you hit the lottery and you go out and buy a 1945 Chateau Becheville from France. And, you know, that's going to take less time because it's so old that it may fall apart quickly in your glass. You probably, the only reason you would decant it is to keep kind of the gnarliness that kind of gathers at the bottom of a wine after a long time of storage, because that adds bitterness and you really don't want that. That's like the old school decanters you see with a little candle at one end and the bottle on the crank. And that was to see when you start seeing the little pieces of sediment coming out, you would turn it back just so that wouldn't get in the wine and make it bitter. So bottom line is the bigger the wine and the younger that it is needs more decanting time than a very, very old one. An older one, you need very little time at all to open it up.
What do you consider old?
I would say old is 20 to 25 years plus.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about extremes. So let's say that, because there's a little bit of a, like a reality to timing. You know, wine is around, you know, hey, honey, let's open a bottle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you open the bottle of wine, then you got to be like, I got to decant this thing for a while, right? So what I'm trying to do in my never-ending approach to be more efficient in my life, what I'm doing is, you know, if I'm working during the day in the house, and, you know, I know it's like 2 or 3 o'clock, right, and I know, you know, the wife will come in 5 or 6 o'clock and we'll start getting and have a glass of wine, I'll start decanting, you know, like around, you know, this maybe 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'll decant it. How long can I leave it in a decanter if I want to go ahead and do it before it starts to go bad? Is the first part mm-hmm. of the question. The second part of the question is, let me just answer that first, and then we'll go to the second
part. All right. Once again, I'm assuming it's just a very young wine that you need to open up for quite a bit. I think when you get to 1 or 2 hours, I think it starts going downhill after that. That's a long time to leave it open. And you'll notice also that when you decant a wine, and, you know, taste the wine up front before you decant it, and then you can taste it along the way. And the wine will also change in your glass as you're, you know, the glass at your beginning of the meal and the glass at the end of your meal will be very, very different. I don't think...
Why is that? Is it because of the time?
It's the time, and it's interacting with the oxygen in the room. So it's... Mm-hmm. That's going on. So it's still working while you're eating and drinking. It's still going on. So I think over 2 hours, and I think you've kind of like been to the mountaintop, and you probably don't need much more. I don't think it's going to improve after that.
Will it go bad? In other words, what I'm doing is I'm trying to say, like, you know, I happen to be in the house this afternoon for lunch.
Right.
I'm going to open it up now. I'm going to put it in the decanter. I'll be back at 5 or 6 tonight and we'll drink it. Is that so?
Probably
cool?
Fine. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not going to go. What's going to go bad is if you leave that bottle of wine open, say you don't put a cork in it and you leave it out for 2 or 3 days, then it starts turning to vinegar. You know, and that's all vinegar is. It's old rotted wine. It's, you know, just, it's had too much oxygen. So it, yeah, and I've had certain bottles. I've opened one day, put the cork in it, gone back the next day, and it's perfectly fine. Sometimes it tastes even better, you know, because I've just sealed it up with the cork. Now, the longevity of it, you know, a little trick I use is if it's a red wine, sometimes I'll put the cap on it, put the cork back in it, and I'd say I have a half bottle left, I'll stick it in the fridge, and then take it out and let it come to room temperature. It keeps that fading. It doesn't stop it. It just slows it down.
Now let's talk about the other end of this, which is, you know, I could probably drink 3 or 4 glasses of wine a night, every night for the rest of my life and love it. And I'll wake up with a hangover headache every single time, right? So for me, at 52 years old, my, you know, years ago, I used to be able to drink, you know.
Sure, we all did.
Right? And we had no problem. Now I have 2 glasses of wine and I'm hungover for a month, right? So the question I have for you is, if I only drank 1 glass, I know you said just put it back in the bottle, maybe in the refrigerator, and you'd probably be fine. Right. There's all these gadgets that are out there, right? The $200 this that pushes air back in it and preserves it. Have you seen them? Have you used them? Do you have experience? What's your thoughts on those things? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Well, there's one that professionals use, and we use it when we're tasting expensive wines. It's a instrument called a Coravin. And what it is a it's a long cardiac needle. And what it does is you put the needle through the top of the cork, and it goes all the way down. And then behind it is a little gas capsule with usually neutral gas, usually argon or nitrogen, because you don't want oxygen in there because that'll kill it. And it will pump in gas and pump out wine, just a small glass. So that way, that bottle can last me weeks or months, and I can pour samples out of it. And I only do that with expensive wines. Like, you know, if it's a $7 bottle of Chardonnay, I'm not too concerned about it, you know. But if it's a $25, $30, $45 bottle of wine, you know, and I need to see a number of customers with it, then, you know, I would bring a Coravin with me and use that. But for practical home use, there's some gases you can use. You know, the problem is between my wife and I, you know, there's usually not the bottle left by the end of the meal. So there's
never happens,
exactly.
Right?
The bottle doesn't stand a chance. But you know, I'll just put a cork in it, and in the next day we'll finish it. You know, it's not designed for long term.
So the cork, they're not cheap, these Coravins. I've seen them.
Yeah,
before.
They're about $300, I think.
Right. So when you think about the $300, is there anything that you think is less expensive that will accomplish for, you know, the person that says, mm-hmm. you know, I live by myself. I only drink a glass a night. And,
right.
you know, sometimes I feel like the cork is just not doing a good job. Is there anything else, like a stopper, or do you think Coravin's the way to go?
No. You know, I see the practical side of it. And like, there's like these things, these vacuum pumps where you put this plastic cork in it, and there's a plastic pump on the outside, and you pump the air out of it. And that works fine, you know, for a day or two, you know, that. And trying to think, there's another one that I can't think of off the top of my head, but there's sometimes you can get gases in a can, and it's like the size of a hairspray can, and it has a long straw on it, and you just put it in the bottle, spray in this gas, and put your cork back on it. That can work for a little bit. If you need to store it for a little bit longer, they're not terribly expensive. I don't know, probably $8 for a can of gas, which just air. It feels like it's empty. But those can work if you need to store it a little bit longer. And, you know, what's kind of funny is that, you know, the wines with the screw caps, the last company I worked for, we did completely unscientific test. We took the corked bottle and we took a screw cap bottle and we opened them and poured out one glass, put the cork back in and put the screw cap back on and tasted it every day. And the one with the cork only lasted 2 to 3 days. The one with the screw cap lasted almost 7 to 10 days. So really, technologically speaking, the screw cap is a better way to go. It's not as sexy.
I can't do it. I mean, if you said to me, "Hey, look, this is some Chateau Lafite," which I'm talking like I know what I'm doing, because I watched a documentary, so I think I'm a big shot now. But like, if you gave me that with a screw cap, I don't even think I'd want it. Like, I just feel like it ruins it, but I know it's efficient. It's certainly easy to get off, and it's easy to put back on.
Well, there's been some wineries. Wineries out in California, there's a guy, Plump Jack, and he started about 10 years ago, and his retail back then was about $110 for a Cabernet. He put a screw cap on it. It was very scandalous back in the day, and I had another story where we had a very high-profile Italian winemaker who made white wine, makes extraordinary white wine, and he came to our meeting, and we met in New York, and he was saying, "Well, you know, I'm thinking of going to screw cap in the next vintage. And what do you guys think of it?" And we're all Americans, and we're like, "Oh, yeah, great idea." Yeah. Or no. And then the one guy, everyone was in favor except for one market. And that was New York. And the New York guy said, you'll ruin the industry. People want to go to the restaurant. They want to have the cork, you know, da, 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 da. And, you know, he said, it's just not a good idea. But the guy said, you know what? Excuse the term, screw it. He says, I'm putting the screw cap on. And the reason he is he says, because it's virtually flawless. You get a thing called a corked wine, which they say happens to between 2-3% of the wines. And what it is a bacteria that gets in the wine, and it won't hurt you, but it fouls the taste of the wine. It's like wet cardboard. You'll know it right away, and you get a funky wet cardboard nose, and it's just a bacteria that gets in the bark of the tree near the bottom of the tree if you don't clean it properly. And so this guy, who's a high-profile winer who still does screw cap to this day, feels that that's just the better technique of making sure his wines are perfect. So now what I would like to see is, like you said, like a Chateau Yquem in France, go to a screw cap, which is like, it's the highest, most expensive dessert wine made. They say you buy it for your grandchildren. Thomas Jefferson had a Chateau Yquem. They can last 300 years. It's amazing. But I'd like to see that in a screw cap and see what happens to that white wine to see if it holds up over time. So that's my diatribe on the screw cap.
All right, screw it. I'll just have a bottle of wine. All right, so let me talk about one more gadget. I purchased something the other day. So, you know, there's this never-ending conversation that people have about sulfites, mm-hmm. right? The sulfites that they add to the wines mm-hmm. It's a preservative mm-hmm. that allows the wine to stay fresher as it gets transported yep. from France to Georgia right. here, right? When I go to Italy, and I go quite often, I notice that they don't have sulfites, and I don't know if it's in my head or not. I know there's a lot of controversial opinions on this, but I don't feel like I get a hangover, and I feel like it helps, right? So this guy came up with this thing. And it's, I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called an ULLO, U-L-L-O, wine purifier. And what it does is it aerates the wine. And he graduated from MIT, and he had trouble with sulfites. And so he created this thing that not only, you just put it on top of a glass or a decanter, you pour the wine into it, and there's a filter. You have to buy the filters. And the filter, supposedly, will pull the sulfites out. You filter it through, and you go into the thing, and it pulls the sulfites out, and it brings it back to the way it was prior to putting the sulfites in it. So I bought it. I've been doing it. And I don't know, just because I paid for it, that I'm waking up in the morning without a hangover.
Right.
I can't tell. But I notice a big difference. So I guess the question is, what's your thoughts on sulfites affecting the wine, i.e. a hangover? And two is, what's your thoughts, if you know anything, on something like this that pulls the sulfites out?
Well, that's the first I've heard of something that pulls the sulfites out. Sulfites are naturally occurring. If you do nothing, when the Romans made wine, there were sulfites on the outside of the grape skin. It's a natural occurrence. Where you get into problems is, and this doesn't happen so much anymore because I think winemakers are more aware of it. But I'll say back in the 70s and early 80s, they used to add sulfite for preservation to wine. And if you screwed it up and did it wrong, you would get a very funky, sulfury nose. It was not appealing, like a rotten egg kind of aroma. It was horrible. Most wineries do not add extra sulfites anymore. It's just a bad thing, and it naturally occurs where it's enough of it. I mean, there are occasions where they will have to add sulfur, but it's very, very measured. They realize that the things that can happen with that. As far as sulfites being pure, it's very difficult to do because it's an unnatural occurrence. You would have to pull them out somehow, and maybe this filter can. It's a first that I've heard of that. I'll have to look that one up.
Yeah, it's ULLO, and it takes about 7 minutes to pour the bottle of wine into the decanter. It's very, very slow, and the filter is definitely getting filled up with right. something. But you know, who the hell knows? It's just another $100 gadget that I bought.
It may work. People that are allergic to sulfites are very, very rare. It's 0.5% of asthmatics. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny percentage. So a lot of times when people think it's sulfite, it may be something else. The sulfurs, like for organic wines in Europe, they do have a lower measure than Americans, but it's parts per million. I mean, it's tiny, tiny, like 12 parts per million instead of like the U.S. where it's 30 parts per million or whatever that number is. But it's a minuscule amount to be called sulfite free. I don't think it plays that big a factor, and especially in your better wines, I don't think you're going to find many sulfites in it. And if you do get an over-sulfured wine, you'll know right away. You'll get that rotten egg smell, and you'll know it's bad. And that's where if you're at a restaurant and you get that taste or that cardboard-like taste, don't be afraid to send it back. And you're not being like a jerk. They need to know that the wine is flawed, and they'll get it back. The distributor will send it back to the winery, and they'll get credit for it. So, you don't have to worry. Or if you take it to the package store or whatever, and I know package stores in different states are kind of funny about the law about bringing back wine, but if it's truly flawed, I think you get a case.
All right. So now we put the glass of wine, we put the wine from the decanter into the glass, and we go through our process. We give it a good swirl. How should we be approaching the smell? Do you just stick your nose in it?
Yeah. The swirling actually does serve a purpose. And I used to be on a panel for a publication down here, and my wife and I were both on the panel, and we would judge wines blindly. And what that means is, say today we're going to taste Chardonnays from Napa Valley, and they would put five bags out there, brown bag the wine, and then pour them. So we have no idea what we're tasting. So this is the technique we would use when we're analyzing wines. And when I'm at home, I'm in the kitchen, I'm not analyzing my wine. I'm just drinking it and enjoying it. But if you're going to analyze the wine, the first thing we do is we look at the color, and it's best to do it over like a white piece of paper or white tablecloth. You can see the color. Then the next thing we would do is swirl the wine, and we're not just being snobs. We're actually doing something that releases the esters and the aromas. Take a big sniffle, kind of make notes of what you're tasting or smelling. And I always tell people, walk down the produce aisle in your head. You know, do you taste grapes? Do you taste apples? Do you taste oranges? Do you taste tangerines? And then I say, take a walk down the spice aisle of the grocery store. Do you, you know, taste cassis? Do you taste cinnamon? Do you taste, so you get like a spice and fruit, those kind of aromas. So there's a reason you swirl it and you put your nose up in there. And that's what you're looking for, is what aromas are you getting in there?
When I watch Gary Vee of Wine Library, right, you know, he's talking about, I smell a tennis ball. I smell, you know, a meatball parmesan. Like, what is that? Is that just like the tennis ball was lying in the vineyard? Like, where are these crazy smells coming from?
What okay, is so when anyone analyzes wine, I compare it to art. You and I and two other people are looking at a picture on the wall. And you know what? We're going to have four different opinions on it. Pretty much so. And when people taste and smell, we're all going to get different opinions on it, slightly. And when we would have a panel, and we weren't allowed to talk while we're judging the wines, because you don't want to influence somebody. You want to say, hey, well, I smell blueberries. And then the guy next to you, yeah, I get blueberries too. So you don't want that. So since it is subjective, you know, one time I smelled like a Band-Aid. I swore it smelled like a brand new Band-Aid. I've smelled one that tasted like a cherry cough lozenge. You know, it's just, you know, but it's your own interpretation. So if Gary smells tennis balls, you know, God bless him, maybe there's just an aroma stuck in his head. It's all subjective. So there's, you know, what you and I and two other people may smell may be four different things. So, you know, don't beat yourself up too badly. If you smell tennis balls, you smell tennis balls.
But it's not to say, I want to make this point, because it's not to say, if somebody says that I smell blackberry, fruit, is that potentially to, or pencil shavings, let's use pencil shavings, I smell pencil shavings. Is that to say that there was potentially pencils that were in the vineyard, or is that have nothing to do with what was there, and it's just what somebody may or may not smell, and there may have not been a pencil within 20 miles.
Exactly. And a lot of people that aren't used to tasting wines, when I would give these descriptors and say, I smell blueberries and apricots and vanilla, they said, was that actually in the wine? And I'm like, no, it's not in the wine, nor was it near it. It's just the aromas that it's putting off. So it was probably nowhere near pencil shavings, although actually pencil lead is a descriptor for Bordeaux from France with Cabernet. You can get a little pencil lead. Somebody said a fresh crayon box. There's all kinds of weird descriptors, but no, it has nothing to do with what's in the wine, actually. It's just the aromas it's putting off.
Okay. That helps a lot. Oh my God, I can't believe I just crushed an hour with you. I can just machine gun you for two more hours. I'm gonna pick and choose my last round of questions here. What's the most expensive bottle of wine you've ever tasted, and what was it like?
Well, I'm going to give you two stories here, and because I was in a restaurant in Raleigh, North Carolina, and if you stay in a lot of hotels, you know that the hotel restaurant is usually the most unbusiest place there is. And so there was another table 5 feet away from it, two gentlemen. And I happened to look over in their table, and they had a bottle of 1945 Chateau Becheville. And it was two surgeons from New York, and they were celebrating something. And the guy brought this from his cellar. And I'm 5 feet away, and I'm by myself. I said, hey, guys, do you mind if I have a taste of that? Just pour me just the tiniest taste. And they said, man, we will, but it's gone. It was corked. It was completely flawed. And I said, look, I want to taste it anyway and just check it off my bucket list that I tasted a 1945 Becheville. So I have no idea what that price was, but I'm sure it was ridiculously expensive. And then the other story, the most expensive one that I know of, I tasted a couple weeks ago in Napa Valley, and it was a $3,000 bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon from a Napa Valley producer, and it was good. I mean, it was good, but it was I could probably find one at $70 or $80 would be just as good. And a lot of the times, it's just supply and demand that creates the price. The most amazing bottle I ever tasted, and I don't know the price of it, but it was an old Barolo, and it really kind of got me into the Italian wine business. And I was so enamored by the layers of flavor, and I think that's what makes a great bottle of wine, regardless of the price. This Barolo was probably 10 to 15 years old. And believe me, Barolos can go. I remember selling a 1949 Barolo, a 1950, and a 1951 Barolo in the 90s. And, they're amazing, the longevity that those wines can have and the quality that they can keep up. But what makes a great wine is the layers of flavor. So you might get rose petals and tar and tobacco leaf and cherry, and the more layers of flavor you get, you're like, wow, every moment. And then, like we talked earlier, it changes in the glass after a little bit of time. So you're getting more flavors, and you just have this, oh, wow, like the Almighty has just came and sat at the table kind of moment. Like, this is amazing, absolutely amazing. And that's what's a great bottle of wine.
Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you about the decanting. After you decant it, let's just say that there's some left in the decanter, but it's in the decanter. Can you pour it back into a bottle?
Yeah.
And cork?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Just take a funnel and put it back
I have done that. I used to do Barolo Brunello pre-sales, and because they're so young and they're fresh, I would pour the whole bottle out into a decanter, swirl it around a little bit, let it get oxidized, mix in with the oxidized, that's bad, but get a little oxygen mixed in, and then pour it back into the bottle through a funnel and cork it. So the next day when I tasted it, it had opened up already. I won't have to decant it because they're young, they're huge wines, and they need time. So yes, you can do that.
All right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm gonna go through something that's completely unrelated to wine. This is just around you. This will be the last couple of minutes of the show. Answer as quickly or as slowly as you'd like. It's basically the first thing that comes to mind rounds. What would one of your friends say is your superpower?
I think that outside of wine, I mean, people know me just because of wine, but I'd say like, maybe it's wine, you know, just because most people, they're just like blown away by like, I've been doing this a long time since I was 17. You know, that's just kind of, that's my knack, and I can match wine and food and pick out flavors. So that's really kind of my life's focus.
What if people never ask you what you wish they did?
Never ask me what you wish they did. I guess I would say, you know, what I think that another thing that people don't ask me is like, you know, patience, how to learn patience, how to work with patience. You know, I find that a good skill, especially as I get older, I get better at it, you know, because I think you can think clearer that way.
What is the one thing that you want to get better at?
One thing I want to get better at. I would say the one thing I would want to get better at would be time organization. And in this day and age, I find it harder just because so much is thrown at you in a day in so many different directions. Sometimes it's hard to kind of keep the boat straight. So I would say just organizing time, making the best use of time.
What book have you reread the most?
Wow. It was actually the, I enjoyed a book by Leo Bascaglia.
The Love Doctor.
Yeah.
You're going back old school now.
Yeah. Bus 9 to Paradise. That was the name. That was, I found that a fascinating read on many different levels. I thought he was, I read that more than once.
I'm going to dust that off. I love that guy.
Yeah.
He's probably on YouTube. We should pull that up.
I bet he is.
He gave great talks. What is your guilty pleasure?
Chocolate. No, a really good chocolate. That's absolutely. I love like getting really good chocolate and tasting them. That's kind of, but I taste it almost like a wine. I like to actually bite into it and just kind of and let it sit on your tongue for a while and with sea salt.
If you had to give a TED talk on nothing that you're known for, i.e. wine, nothing that you speak about, and anything that you like to do or you have a passion for, but it's unrelated to wine, what would it be?
You know, that was, you know, and I hate to go back, but I'd say like the value of patience and judgment. I think that, you know, I sit on a panel of a zoning board in a city, and you get to hear a lot of stories about how businesses and the troubles they run into and residentials in the present. And you really have to, you can't let the emotions get the best of you. And it's learning how to judge, make a clear judgment. I think that would be an interesting discussion.
I do too. All right. Last question. We're going to change things up a little bit. What one question would you like to ask me?
The one question I did ask you, if you could have a bottle of wine with anybody, living or dead, who would you have it with?
That's a great question.
Threw you a curveball.
Well, when you put wine in it, I've been asked that question before, but not with a bottle of wine.
Just because the wine might make the conversation more interesting.
I'm gonna answer this question probably in a way that's not gonna be very impressive, but it'll be honest. If I were around wine, it would be with the, I wish I knew his name, you'll know it, the guy who's from California that's in all the Somme movies that does all the blind tasting, and you know, you give him like a sip of anything and he'll be like, that's a cab from 1942. You know that guy?
Fred Clark?
He's wearing he's in like camo in one of the episodes. You know what I mean? He's snarky. He's with all these highfalutin French people and English people, and he's just cracking jokes. Doesn't take himself seriously,
right?
But he's incredible. It's Fred something, I think.
Yeah,
and he's he's just on his
Fred. Dame. I think it's Fred Dame. Dame.
That's exactly who it is. The guy I would have a glass of wine with, because I feel like I can relate to him, and I know that there is an enormous wealth of knowledge that he could teach me about what that glass of wine is trying to tell me. Well, brother, I cannot thank you enough. I haven't asked if you wouldn't mind, maybe you can shoot me a message with, a short wine list, maybe four or five wines that, you should try this producer, try this wine, and if you have some for chocolate, that would be great. And I'll link that up in the show notes so people who are completely oblivious.
Yeah,
after they've gotten, if you've made it all the way through this interview, at the end of the interview, and you're like, okay, I still don't know where to start. If you can give them a couple of things that they're likely to be able to find in your local wine store, whether it's with your company or not, would be just awesome.
Oh yeah, love to do that.
Do you have any final words, suggestions, or an ask for the people that are listening?
I would just say, go out and try different wines. Don't be afraid to go walk out on a limb. Take a chance on a bottle. And I really think you'll find it a pleasant experience. And have fun with it.
Well, I got to tell you, Jim, you crushed this interview. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks for listening. If you love this episode and you know someone that needs some help in either stepping up their work hard game or their play hard game, it would mean the world to me if you shared this podcast with them to help me get this movement out there. So if you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes, take 30 seconds, and leave me a 5-star review, and I will be forever grateful. So until the next episode, excuses are over. It's time to live.